God-loving brothers and fathers, after much labor, God has counted us worthy to publish the book of my elder of blessed memory, who is also your spiritual grandfather, and I consider this a fitting occasion to offer a few additional remarks. It is meant to help you with what you will read in his book, so that your reading becomes more beneficial and richer. Of course, I have spoken to you about the elder many times, but I think that now, more than ever, it becomes necessary to remind you of what I have already said, and perhaps also something more that I may have remembered now, something I had forgotten in years past. You know, your grandfather, when he was in the world as a young man, had no religious life at all. He was a pure man, reasonable, just, and honest in all his dealings. He hated injustice with all his heart. He had thrown himself into his work, into commerce, because his family was very poor. And he told himself, either I will grow rich, or it is better to die. I have had my fill of the poverty and misery in my home, and so he gave himself entirely to his work. And indeed, because he was a clever man, a great mind, from the time he was young and came to Athens from the island, he earned a great deal and had built up a sizable fortune. So pure was his life that, tellingly, before he set out for the holy mountain, before God granted him his great repentance and his return to God, he had become engaged, and he would tell me, "My child, I lived so carefully that I never once touched that young woman, nor did I ever go so far as to kiss her." After this, one day, at a certain moment, he reads a religious book and see how God drew him in. On that day, when he began to become faithful to God, and afterward, when repentance came, there came over him a sorrow. A despondency, a weariness with worldly things. In the house where he was staying, the landlady had two devout daughters. When they saw the elder looking so sad, withered, and dispirited, they said to him, "Brother Francis," for that was his name in the world, "we see that you are sad." "I don't know. No appetite. I don't know what is happening to me," he says. "I have such a heaviness even toward my own work." "Let us give you," they say, "a fine book to read, to pass the time, and perhaps it will lift your spirits." And they hand him the Eclogium of the Saints, that is a carefully chosen collection of the lives of the saints, and after the elder read it, he says, "But do such people really exist? Did such people truly live? Ascetics, saints with miracles, with signs and wonders?" Then the remembrance of God came to him, and from that time God sent him repentance, sent him his illumination, opened his noose, and he began to think about his soul. From there his new spiritual journey began. He went and confessed his sins to his spiritual father with many, many tears. Here, for the first time, he began to grow cold toward commerce. He now saw it as an obstacle, as sin, this business of trading, of telling lies, and so many other things, and he abandoned commerce and began to work very simply, here and there, to earn his daily bread. And the money he had gathered from his work, from his trade, he began to give away here and there for the memorial of his father and so on at the various shrines to strengthen his faith and his repentance and his change of life, and through the reading he did on the lives of the saints. He thought that, before departing, before leaving to become a monk, he should devote himself as fully as possible to ascesis while still living in the world, so as to test in some measure his capacity for the monastic life. He would go out to Mount Penteli and spend the night up in the trees, seeking to imitate the stylites. He fasted all day and got by on one or two leucomia, or a little bread over the whole day and night. He made many prostrations. He lived on a very simple and austere diet. He scattered his money so as to keep none on him at all, and in short, he began to imitate the saints. When at last he saw that he was able to live the ascetic life, that he could become a monk, he makes his decision. He arranges his sister's marriage, gives her a suitable dowry, and one day, young, at the age of 24 or 25, he sets off for the holy mountain. His aim was to find an ascetic who ate nothing but wild greens, kept vigil throughout the night, and was a man of nepsis, of spiritual watchfulness. This was the purpose that brought him to the holy mountain, and as soon as he set foot there, he made his way to the wilderness. He kept asking here and there where such ascetics might be found, and people told him that ascetics like that do not exist today, that they have died out, that their kind has come to an end. The ones remembered today as the greatest spiritual men reach only as far as restraining themselves to eat once a day. Not wild greens. This grieved him deeply because he did not find what he had read of in the books, in the lives of the saints he had read while still in the world. Even so, he did not sit idle. He began to search, to travel all over the holy mountain, from cave to cave, handspan by handspan, in the hope of discovering some such ascetic whom perhaps the people here on the holy mountain simply did not know. And indeed he found none. He did not find one. He found only that certain ascetics ate once a day. He had heard of Elder Daniel, that he was a spiritual man. He stayed near him for a while, and as he told us, he would read the Psalter and weep over the Psalter. He read very beautifully. They would have him read the appointed readings at the feasts, the hermitages held there, on the commemorations of the saints, and he wept the whole time. Elder Daniel saw that he was a deeply spiritual young man, and he said to him, "My child, you are not suited to my brotherhood. Go back to your cave, and I will see to finding you a brother, so that the two of you may be together, because on your own it will not do. It is far too dangerous. You might fall into delusion." "May it be blessed," he said, "Elder," and from time to time he would come down and take his counsel. Then, to put it briefly, Elder Arsenios came from Jerusalem, from the desert down there. He came to the holy mountain and went to the monastery of Stavronikita, but since that monastery followed the idiorhythmic way of life, he who sought stillness left the monastery, came into the desert, and went to Elder Daniel, who was renowned in those days as a deeply spiritual and learned man. "Yes, Elder, I too have come here into the desert to live as a monk. I love stillness, and so on. We have a very fine young man here in a cave, and it would be good for you to visit him. Perhaps he will receive you, and the two of you can live together, so that he too is not on his own, for it is better to be together, each one helping the other." And so it came to pass. Elder Arsenios went. They came to know one another, and afterward they joined together, and again on the guidance of Elder Daniel, they went and lived in community under Elder Ephraim and Elder Joseph, who were kinsmen and lived as monks together at Katunakia. Both of them were very simple, Arvanite men, and he lived as a monk near them. Now, one day, let me tell you something about how hard the elder struggled against the passion of anger. One day, a Cretan monk who lived nearby there at Katunakia began insulting Elder Ephraim. He spoke harshly to him, many very harsh words. And Elder Ephraim, being the simple man he was, raised his voice because he was deeply distressed by the monk who was insulting him and saying so many things against him. The poor man kept shouting. He simply could not cope with it. The elder, being still young and newly arrived, with his passions, of course, still very much alive, the moment he heard the elder outside, crying out, and heard the wrong the other one, the Cretan, was doing to him, the anger flared up within him to rush outside and do what he would have done. The moment he felt himself thus angered, enraged, from what I might call a holy indignation, because he saw his elder being pressed hard by the man outside, he understood that things would not go well if he went straight out and met that elder. So he went into the Church of the Annunciation, fell down upon the ground, and began to weep. He cried out, "My most holy Theotokos, come quickly, help me, for if I go out now, I do not know what will happen. Help me, save me, take this passion from me, this anger, this rage, and weeping and lamenting there on the ground and drenching it with many, many tears." He saw the anger, the passion, give way. It grew calm, reason returned to its place, and he went out and spoke to that elder in a very calm manner. And he parted from Elder Ephraim. He spoke to that elder very calmly but firmly, putting him in his place. And so nothing happened. The elder told me, "My child, if anger had overcome me and I had gone outside, even I do not know what would have happened. When I was young and living in the world, I had such strength," he said, "and such boldness within me that I could take on 10 men. 10 men could not stand against me. They could not get the better of me. Imagine now if I had gone out and seen my elder."
Thank you.
I came to know him during my monastic life. From that time on, I felt my anger and wrath subside and lose their former intensity. In this way, the progress I was making began to heal my heart within me. Afterward, he rendered complete obedience to Elder Ephraim. After Elder Ephraim had embraced the life of Hesychia together with Elder Joseph, and he and Elder Arsenios were now free to devote themselves more fully to the spiritual struggle. They went up to St. Basil's even before he placed himself under obedience to Elder Ephraim. He visited many caves of great saints of the Holy Mountain, including those of St. Athanasios the Athenite, St. Nilos the Myrrh Streamer, St. Peter the Athenite, and many others. In fact, while he was at Agios Vasileos, he and Elder Arsenios once set out barefoot to walk to the Lavra to go to their spiritual father so they could attend the divine liturgy and be edified. They set out one day, through deep snow, to reach their spiritual father. When they reached the cold springs below Athos, the elder, since he kept a stricter fast than Elder Arsenios, had become utterly exhausted. He was literally frozen, and he said to Elder Arsenios, "Arsenios, let us go no further, for I am finished." And there, where they stopped, they cleared away a little of the snow and managed to find a few sticks and lit a small fire. And all night long it was prostration after prostration, prostration after prostration, until dawn broke and they turned back. The elder practiced many other ascetic labors as well, and by the grace of God he had purified himself completely, above all from the passion of the flesh. And, as a striking example, one day when he was keeping vigil, in the midst of the prayer he was saying, his eyes closed and he sees a demon before him, and the wrestling began. And as he was struggling with the demon and had seized him firmly, it appears that he was calling out to Elder Arsenios, "Arsenios, bring fire so we can burn him," he says. "Now that I have caught him, he will not get away," he says. And as he had gripped the devil and bound him, an elder Arsenios went and lit, as he saw it there, the fire to throw the demon in and burn him. The demon became a raven and fled. When he awoke, he saw that he had now been freed from the passion of the flesh. As he also used to tell us, the plaster on the walls of his cell was damaged everywhere from the punches and blows struck during his struggles with the various demons that came at night and grappled with him. Once, among the ascetic practices we have been describing, he wanted to pray all night long standing, 10 hours, 12 hours on his feet. How could he stay standing that long? He thought of making a kind of staff, a special one such as you may have seen, and so he would lean upon it, and with the prayer rope, and even without the prayer rope, he would pray. One day, while he was struggling intensely in his ascetic discipline, who knows how many hours he had been standing there, keeping vigil, he collapsed. He had a small oil lamp nearby, its tiny flame barely burning, and when he fell, just imagine, he did not even realize that he had fallen. When he awoke, who knows how many hours later, he said, "Where am I?" The lamp had been knocked over, its oil spilled on the floor, and his staff had been flung aside. Only then did he understand that he had collapsed from standing and keeping vigil for so long. At another time he lived in strict enclosure and would not go out at all. Through the little window Elder Arsenios would come and give him his rusk every so many days. And after he had been shut in for many days, because he got no fresh air where he stayed, one night he opened the little window to take in a little air, and the moment the fresh air struck him, he grew dizzy and fell out of the window. Joseph was exceedingly strict, and in self-control exceedingly so. When Great Lent arrived, that is when his fasting reached its very peak. Well, when we were together for that first Lent, the fast he set for us seemed very severe to us, of course. But he, in the earlier years, in the earlier Lents, had kept an even stricter fast. He and Elder Arsenios used some little dishes, deep little bowls, into which they would put I do not know how many spoonfuls of food. That little bitter dish was their food for a full 24 hours without any bread, just barely enough to stay on their feet so they could keep up the struggle. When he was at Agios Vasileios, his weakness reached the point where he could not even go to church to attend the liturgy. And on a certain great feast day, when they were to go to church to receive Holy Communion, he says to Elder Arsenios, "You go, Arsenios, for I cannot even get up. I will stay here and continue the prayer. You go to church." Elder Arsenios left, and as the elder sat bent over in his small, dark cell, continually saying the Jesus prayer in his heart, unceasingly, never letting his mind wander outside his heart, he suddenly felt someone nudge him on the head. He lifts his head. It was dark now, The elder lifts his head and sees before him a radiance, a light, and in this light a most beautiful angel, who held in his left hand a small, exceedingly bright box, and in his right hand a communion spoon, and he gestures to him to prepare himself, for he was going to commune him with the holy bread. The elder understood, and being caught up in this vision, in which he could no longer think in human terms, but was under the influence of that spiritual phenomenon, under the influence of the angel, of the mystery, of the grace, of the vision, he did, without willing it, what God was telling him to do. And he opened his mouth and received communion from the angel's hand with the holy bread. And after the angel departed, he bowed his head again, and began the prayer once more. And consider now what his spiritual state must have been, with holy communion, and with the angel's grace and presence like that. Of course, by the time I came to him, he was moderate in his strictness, compared with the strictness he had when he was at St. Basil's. Quite a few people went to live as monks under him at St. Basil's. His reputation as a great ascetic had spread, but they could not remain with him because, in a certain sense, he was very uncompromising in his views on monastic and ascetic life. Later, when I went down to Little St. Anna's, where I myself met him, he was strict, as you probably know. With me especially, he was constantly coming down hard. Of course, God illumined him to treat me in this way, because I had a great deal of pride and much rust within my soul. That is why God showed him that this was how he needed to guide me spiritually, so that I might be cleansed. Thus, he was extremely strict at St. Basil's, moderately strict at Little St. Anna's, and when we reached New Skeet, he was less strict still. When Father Panteleimon, who is now in America, had come, and they recounted to him how the elder had treated me in particular, he couldn't believe it, because he had found the elder so gentle and soft. The elder used to tell us, when I was at St. Basil's, I was very strict. I was a young man. Now, the older I grow, the more I change my approach. Just as some great general said, some great man in a certain country, I don't quite remember. He said that, when he was young, he governed his army and everything else with strictness and severity, but when he grew old, he governed and prevailed and held sway over the soldiers and everyone else through love. And I too, he said, now, at the age I have reached, I think we must deal with people with much love and condescension. And that is why I am now so gentle. In the first great Lent we kept together, the elder gave us no bread for 5 days of the week, nor any food, in fact. He had simply given us 25 drams of flour each, which we made into a gruel, and that is what we ate over the 24 hours of each of those 5 days. On the weekend he made us food with bread. At night, 10 hours of vigil in prayer, with a double and triple rule of prayer on the prayer ropes and prostrations. During the day, very hard work, something that of course benefited us greatly in our souls. Whereas we today are very weak people, in soul and body alike, and we cannot even conceive that we could fast like this. All these examples from the elder's life must become our own, a help to us, so that we too, as far as we are able, may strive to resemble him in Assisi. Above all in the spiritual part, in vigil, in prayer, in purity, in his illumined spiritual mind. For at the very moment when we have him as our elder, when we have this spiritual kinship, as his spiritual children, we have a sacred duty to follow in his footsteps as far as we can. He placed great emphasis on silence among us. He would not allow us to speak with one another. Indeed, we did not even know what idle talk meant within our brotherhood. We were constantly saying the Jesus prayer. I remember once saying to him, "Sometimes, elder, I would say from the Jesus prayer my mouth aches, my tongue aches, my throat has closed up, I cannot breathe." He would say nothing but patient endurance, and he would keep on with the prayer. "Nothing is wrong with you," he would tell me. "My heart hurts," I said. "Nothing is wrong with your heart." And indeed, the benefit was very great. Many times, so much grace came through the Jesus prayer spoken aloud that a person felt such divine love within, such a rapture of the nous, the spiritual intellect. While carrying out your obedience, you would see yourself doing something with your hands, some kind of work. And yet somehow the nous was not merely in prayer, but in theoria, in the vision of God, as though it were already in the other world, of the world. I would push the elder along so that we could go to church at night, because he could not walk on account of his illness. Along the way, and, as you know, up on the mountain, the ground is not level. The road is uneven in many places, and therefore presents many difficulties as I pushed the elder from behind. It was, of course, his prayer that made all this possible. Many times I realized that I was not truly with the elder. I was pushing him, but I was not close to him. My noose, my spiritual mind was elsewhere. And then, on the uphill stretches, I would come to myself again, and realize once more that I was with Jana's and George, and then my mind would wander off again. I would think and say to myself, what is the spiritual life? What grandeur there is in monasticism? How it makes a person like this and transforms him, changes him. The nos becomes so light, so spiritual, and it overcomes every difficulty and reaches to where words can no longer express it. I would say to him, Elder, sometimes in my prayer I cannot. My noose does not rise past the roof of my cell. Why? Because I feel this obstacle, he would say. The demons, my friend, who are present unseen, they hinder it, by permission, by the economy of God, for the sake of some teaching that God may give you through experience. And at other times, you would see the mind completely unhindered by anything in the spiritual realm, and like a bullet, with unimaginable and incomprehensible speed, it would rise and touch those things that transcend the material creation. Why, elder, I would say to him, do I feel no difficulty over my sins? No difficulty in thinking on and contemplating my departure? No difficulty in getting past the toll houses when I tried to set my nose, my very self, on the left hand of the judge at the second coming, and it will not go there? But unwillingly, unhindered, and effortlessly it goes toward the right. Well, don't you understand? He said to me, they are not understood. The moment you, as an obedient disciple, laid your whole burden upon my shoulders, upon my back, you were made light, he said. For what will you have to give an account, when you have entrusted everything to me, laid it all down before me, and I have taken it up, so that now you are free? How could you not go there? What could possibly hold you back? And the elder was right, because we did nothing without asking the elder first. Beyond that, I struggled to make the elder's own belief my belief. By his grace, I never once committed the fault of holding anything in my mind different from what the elder held as his own conviction. For this is how I felt. I could truly be an obedient disciple. I did not want to be obedient only outwardly, merely carrying out his commands in my task, in the handiwork, in whatever he ordered me to do. That kind of obedience I counted as nothing, as a merely bodily matter. What I wanted was an obedience of the soul, of the spirit, an obedience at the very level of my person, hypostatic obedience. I felt that obedience meant this. Only through his prayers and the prayers of my mother would I reach the point of becoming truly obedient, as one who is obedient according to God ought to be. When the elder pondered something and made a decision, I was in complete agreement with him. In the beginning, when I first became a monk, thoughts of longing and love toward my parents and so forth would come to me, and I would say, how can I divide my love? To love too, God and my parents. I regard it as a kind of adultery against God because all my love, my whole heart, had to be given to God alone. This did not mean that I should hate my parents or other people, not in the least, not at all, but it was necessary. It became my duty. I had to feel that my conscience was sincere before God, who knows my heart, and that I must give it to him completely, offering him the fullness of my love. This, of course, was the elder's teaching. Strive to become obedient disciples, he would say, not sickly and shriveled ones, but obedient as we read of in the books. Let the accounts and the great deeds of the obedient not remain only in the books. Let that state of obedience, the obedience of those heroic disciples, be lived out even today. That is why, after such teaching, we could not sit around in idle talk or pass judgment or speak freely in the elder's presence. It simply did not happen. The proof is that never, among ourselves, we, the brothers of the brotherhood, were we ever scandalized or embittered against one another. When the elder finally saw that we could no longer remain at Little St. Anne's, because we younger monks had begun to buckle, that is, our health was failing, he realized something had to be done. They were elderly, and we were young, yet we had begun to become crippled by the harsh life, by all the hardship we endured, by the unhealthy conditions there, and especially by the cells, which were truly like tombs. My own cell in particular was a veritable tomb, family warfare in the world. I, for my part, had begun to have troubling conditions and symptoms. The elder prayed and then said to us, "Children, we must set out tonight. We need to go down to Neas Gate to Elder Theophylactos, whom the elder had tonsured into the great schema. He had come up, met the elder, and become acquainted with us. Later, the elder tonsured Elder Theophylactos into the great schema and took over his little house at Neas Gate. The elder said, 'I have received assurance from God that we must now go down lower, because at the rate we are going here, no one will be left standing on his feet. And how are we to live here, when you younger ones will be crippled?' 'Indeed, you have already been crippled,' he said. And after he received this assurance from God, we all set out together one night, under the moonlight, and made our way down to the Holy Unmercenaries at Neas Skete. Then we brought down the few belongings we had up there and stayed within the Skete, because the elder could no longer remain up there, and neither could we. He said, 'My child, what shall we do now? Certain difficulties had also arisen with the fathers there. We are not suited for this place. We are peaceful men. We cannot live here with these disputes. So we must leave. Will you not go into the monastery and tell the abbot, Seraphim, at that time, that we are leaving?' I went to the monastery and said to the elder, the abbot, and he said to me, 'Why should you leave?' and so on. 'Let us give you these hesychastic huts that lie outside the skate. You have only to say the word, sir, and we give them to you free of charge.' I returned and told this to the elder, and he said to me, 'Go and see what these huts are like.' I went. I saw them. They pleased me, and I said, 'This is exactly what we need, elder.' I went and saw them, and they are just right. He said, 'Let us get up and go.' 'No, elder, better that you should see them yourself as well, in case they do not please you.' And then, 'I will not be able to bear it on my conscience that I have distressed you and grieved you, and you came here and it did not please you.' 'No, my child,' he said, 'since it pleased you, since the huts and the place and the rest pleased you, then they please me too,' he said. So we set out, and indeed we went. The elder was amazed. 'It is suited to the hesychastic life,' he said. 'We have found a cave here as well. We are outside the skete. This is something quite special. We have no administrative ties to the skete, so from now on we will be able to live in stillness and keep the rule we learned in the desert.' And indeed, we kept it to the very end. And afterward, as the distilled fruit of all his ascesis, the elder drew a conclusion which he told me one day. 'My child,' he said, 'as we were today, we ought to be settled somewhere low like this, where we can easily find what we need, so that we are not worn out overmuch with loads on our backs, far off, deep within. We would spend all our strength there and wear ourselves out, so that at night we could no longer keep vigil comfortably at all. What would it be like, carrying supplies, food, and so on? Down below,' he said, 'the waves would strike the cell. A person can reach that point and devote his hours, so to speak, to prayer, with the freedom from material concerns that he may have. For as John had learned, and as we too had learned, many of us had my share too.'"
Thank you.
"Is this, that one should find a spiritual guide with little bodily hardship, and should keep a rule regarding prayer and self-control. This is what we found, more or less, in the first skete we came down to, and down here in the skete where we settled. And there we kept our rule exactly, our order, our prayer, the liturgies every day, confession, strictness in our speech, and we lived very beautifully. Until God judged and decided and took the elder up into the heavens. From up there where he is, he sees very clearly how things unfold. He sees how we labor here. He prays for us. He intercedes continually. He beseeches God to care for us. To care for us somewhat more, because we do not have the ascesis that he knew as his own, nor do we have his spiritual state. He sees the dangers we pass through, he sees our failings, he sees our passions, he sees so many things, and he beseeches God to be merciful toward our faults and our passions. And let me tell you this as well, which is truly edifying. It is something we ourselves live through here. Here I want to tell you something about our brother Job. When the brother fell asleep in the Lord, some time passed, and when we had held the vigil of the honorable forerunner, My dear Stavros, the Holy Forerunner has always had a special place in my heart, and that day was also my birthday, the day I came into this world. On that day we held an all-night vigil here at our monastery. I experienced that vigil very deeply, and I felt the Holy Forerunner very much alive within me with great joy. I celebrated his vigil with great joy. The vigil ended. We went to rest, and we slept. When I awoke here from sleep, I awoke with a blessedness.
Something you do not know. With a state of soul and body together, as if in a spiritual nourishment of the grace of God.
This is where the assurance begins, that what I saw was from God. I saw that from our monastery here, I set out with an invisible man. Who was the angel, the guardian of the soul of our brother Iou? I, this angel, and the sun. It was as though this angel and I took him and brought him to the elder in the desert, to our huts there at Little St. Anne's. We arrived there, I see. I, as though I had broken into a sweat from the effort, went to my own little hut to change my undershirt. My escort took John and brought him to the elder, who was in his hut. Once I had made myself ready, I came out of my hut and went to the elder to make my prostration, to tell him that we had brought the brother, and then about the rest. I enter the elder's hut, and I see him sitting on the ground as he usually sat, with Elder Arsenios beside him, and behind the elder there were other people as well, but because it was night, we had arrived at night, and the elder was keeping vigil there in his hut. I went in, I knelt, I took his hand, I kissed it, I placed it to my mouth, to my forehead, and to both my eyes as a blessing. I say, Elder Arsenios, I will make a prostration to you as well. No, he says, do not make it to me. Make it to the elder. I have no need of a prostration. No, I say, I will make a prostration to you too. And now we were speaking to the elder soul to soul. We understood one another in a very mysterious way, the way perhaps people will speak to one another in the other world. I say to him, Elder, we were looking for Job. Yes, he says, he is right next door, in the other little cell, with his companion. Do you want me to bring him back? Do you want them to plead for him to come back to life? For where he is now, he has not entered in, he has been settled. And as I was saying these things there with the elder, I came to myself and woke up, and I felt so beautiful, so happy in my soul, in a way I cannot put into words. And this is a confirmation, a proof that it was from God, and that it truly came to pass. So here we see that the elder from above covers us with his prayers, protects us, illumines us, and waits for us one by one to settle us near God, near his own place, which he has received there as an inheritance from God, as a reward for his ascetic labors. And in that place he waits for each one of us from here to settle us there, so that together with the elder we may form one brotherhood, one monastery, and the kingdom of God. Let us too, fathers, take these accounts to heart, and through what we will read in his book, let us strive as much as we can to make our lives more spiritual and more truly monastic, so that our souls may be benefited. Let us become true grandchildren of this holy man. We had the special blessing to be his own people, and also the honor to have in our brotherhood this man, this saint, as a father, as a grandfather, as a protector, as something that spiritually adorns our brotherhood. The elder will rejoice up above when he sees us not only loving him, but striving to become like him as best we can. Of course, it is impossible for us to reach his virtue, but even a small effort will satisfy him in his soul. For let me recount this too, which fits with what I am saying here. When we were doing the 40 liturgies for the elder, he had not yet reached the 40th day, and one day, after the divine liturgy that I served, behold, I found myself in a great hall full of grace, full of light, with a mysterious spiritual grace. There in the hall was a hierarch's throne. Upon the hierarch's throne was the elder, seated upon the throne. He was all life, very spiritually beautiful. He shone, he blazed, his face gave off sparks to the right and to the left. On his right I saw Elder Arsenios, and on his left Father Athanasios, his brother and his monk, who is at Newskate. At one moment I saw them like this, as three distinct figures. Then I saw the elder take on the form of Christ in all his majesty, with the most holy Theotokos, all holy on his right, and the forerunner on his left. One moment I saw the three of them, the next, their human faces, and then the divine figures. And when I looked again at the elder and the two brothers, again they had the posture of Christ, of the most holy Theotokos, and of the forerunner, something I cannot put into words. And I see myself as if I were coming from outside, and I arrived and entered into New Skeet, and it was as if the place I was coming from had no end. The thing was very deep, but we were entering into that hall. And going forward and entering first, I drew near. The elder upon the throne was in an anguish of expectation. He was waiting. And as soon as I came near, "Who has come?" he says to me. I say, "Who?" "It is I, Ephraim." What joy I have! What joy I have that they are coming! And then I took my place, and he was gazing into the distance with anguish at those who were coming. And from afar I saw Papa Charalambos coming, and then the other brothers, and then his spiritual children, whom he had and still has now in this life. I believe he has this same concern there in the other world where he now is, the concern that we should not be condemned to hell, that we should not lose those good things which he now enjoys and beholds, and which he foresees will be given after the second coming to those who have conquered sin, conquered the passions, and conquered the demons. What will be revealed after the second coming has been fulfilled, when God Christ, the Lamb who was sacrificed together with the whole company of the saints and the saved souls, arrives at that paradise which has been closed, when he opens it and they enter with rejoicing steps and resurrectional joy, when they enter and he says to them, "Behold paradise, behold, as it were, the divine gift bestowed upon you." All this the elder knows very well there where he is above, and fearing lest anyone lose his soul and fail to gain these things, and be deprived of all this great divine blessing and richness, and instead go down below into hell, the terrible, the eternal hell, dwelling together with the demons and with those condemned in that terrible hell, seeing all this, both the one and the other, he is in this anguish of which I speak, he prays and beseeches God that no one may fall away, and that no one may lose his soul. So, in just a few words, and with this brief description, as best I could, I have tried to give you a picture of the blessed elder whom we honor today. He is our crown. He is our saint, one of the great spiritual summits of the Holy Mountain, one of those who practiced ascesis in this place, and sanctified it through all their toil, hardship, and sweat. They sweated, they wept, they watered this place with many tears of repentance and love of God, and for this God has glorified these men so, and until the consummation of the age he will glorify them, according to the word, "Those who glorify me, I will glorify in return." The elder will rejoice, and he keeps rejoicing, as we said, if we try even very simply and modestly to become like him. And because the elder used to tell us many things from his life so that they would remain with us as something beneficial, to be recalled and to profit us afterward, like a spiritual inheritance from his labors. Just as he left us, these things he told us here. We ourselves have often said how wonderful it would have been if our own elder had done the same in his day, how much we would have had to tell. And because we would have wished that this had happened, I continue to speak about more of these things, so that they may remain with you, and if life continues with those who come after you as well. For those who came after, until the time comes when all these passing things here will come to an end. Let us take care, as much as we can, to say the Jesus prayer more often, children, as we used to say it then with the elder. Let your lips never cease saying, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me." Let us avoid unnecessary talk, and let no harmful words escape us, words that defile us. Words that pollute the air, scandalize others, and afterward weigh heavily on our souls. And let this be a small benefit for you, a kind of inheritance, so that something may remain with you for your benefit and spiritual help, how we should keep vigil as much as we can, and how we too ought to help. Thank you. And if we are to attain a spiritual state, and not remain barren in soul, without spiritual progress, we must also know how to struggle inwardly, with nepsis, watchfulness. That is why, from time to time, I will read you a short passage from one day's entry in the diary, so that we may be edified in this respect as well. And so we will bring things to a close tonight as well. Let me read you something from yesterday. March 29, 1979. Glory to God. I have begun to recover from the disruption caused by circumstances, and from the exertion and all the rest of the feast day celebration. I rose for the vigil in my cell. I made my coffee and took up my prayer rope for the prostrations with the sign of the cross. I finished, and just as I sat down for the little noetic prayer, behold, my Father and God came, with his most sweet divine countenance, and from the touch he made upon my intellect and my heart, the tears began to flow and to sweeten all my inner being. My God and my Father, you have bestowed a great honor upon me, to know you and to see you as you are today within my soul. You freely gave me your divine love, even though I was never worthy of such a gift, which surpasses the capacities of my poor soul. You loved me, my Father, before I loved you, and this because you give your love to whomever you will and as much as you will. It is not for man to find it whenever he supposes or wishes, by some natural power he might happen to possess as one endowed with gifts. You do not know how greatly you comforted me tonight, just now by your coming. The days passed in your absence, and I withered away. I grew pale and was left without boldness before you. And now that you have appeared again, coming of your own will, moved with compassion for the sorrow of my heart, you do not know what refreshment and relief you have given me. The sweet tears you granted me fall like the dew of Hermon upon the parched ground of my heart, and now I feel refreshed and relieved with boldness before you, and I cry out to you, my Father, weeping from divine love and tenderness of heart. My God, without you I cannot live, and now that, in your providential dispensation, you withdrew from me. A despondency had seized me, because my poor little soul seemed to be seeking, searching for you in pain, and not finding you, it fainted and cried out. But behold, you came of your own accord as Master and Lord. I thank you, my soul thanks you beyond measure. I melt away in unceasing thanksgiving and worship. Before your majesty, I bow my head in adoration, my heart filled with tenderness toward you. I kiss you, I embrace you as a son, yet so very sweetly, my God and my Father. I await you always, expecting that you will reveal something new to me with your next coming. Come, I am waiting for you. Now Holy Week draws near, and this year we are counted worthy to come to know. We are counted worthy to live through these great days, days so full of compunction, so beneficial for our soul. The divine passion draws near. Let us prepare ourselves inwardly. Let us be watchful, because on such days the devil too always makes himself ready to stir up temptations for us, so that we might be deprived of the special grace of these holy days. With prayer, with attentiveness, with obedience, with compunction, with as much vigil as we can keep, let us welcome these holy days so that we may feel them deeply within our soul, so that we may feel and come to know how God suffered for us. Let it be, if possible, revealed to us the greatness of the divine love through the crucifixion, and afterward let us come to a living sense of the divine resurrection, the life-giving resurrection of Christ, which is a majesty, a faint expression of the eternal resurrection that souls will taste in the other world. The joy of the resurrection is something altogether extraordinary. From this small taste of the divine resurrection, when it is accompanied, of course, by the resurrection of our own souls, we will come to experience the resurrection of our Christ. And this will be only the faintest foretaste of the eternal resurrection and the eternal Pascha that souls will experience in the world to come after the second coming. So then, let us prepare ourselves inwardly for these great days, and let us take great care. And this I warmly implore, that we all look ahead and take our precautions so that no temptation may arise, no quarrel that could embitter us and diminish the benefit and the joy we have been awaiting on these holy days for a whole year. And may the prayers of our holy elder from heaven reach us in time and help us to live as God wills.